Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, that's it, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Kay Thompson Live Show. My name is Eric Payne. I'm also known as The Sun, and you are the host. And who?
I'm your mother, Eric Payne, and how are you this night? What's going on? Is there something going on that we should be talking about? Yes, as a matter of fact, there is. And I have a person who's going to be on the line in about a few minutes, and her name is Elise Wiggins. And, you know, it's really fascinating because the fact that she wrote this book that I've become very impressed with, you know, and the name of the book is Farewell to Welfare. And what Elise does is she gives 25 strategies to freedom, independence, and prosperity. And what is so amazing about it is that she has gone through such awful changes, you know, and she didn't expect to be where she was, and then she came out of it beautifully. And she wrote about these strategies that she uses, and now she has her doctorate degree, and she is doing just fine. And she decided to write this book to tell other people, other women who were in the same kind of circumstances, you know, how to, you know, get out of the situation they were in. We're going to be talking to her. I think she's going to be calling in probably shortly after 8 o'clock. Some of the things that she's going to be talking about will be from welfare to financial stability. And she made some of the most important decisions in her life. As a matter of fact, you know, she was in a position where she was doing fine, and then all of a sudden she had a sudden change in income, in personality, and in trying to take personal responsibility. And she really made it work for herself. She just, you know, said, well, I'm going to take this, you know, right in my hands, and I'm going to find the way to, improve my situation. I'm going to find the way to be out of this welfare thing, which she had never decided or never knew that she would be in. So it's just about one of those things that sometimes you get into a situation where your financial stability has changed. So she talks about her life before welfare. And she also talks about the life of her situation where she changed one of the most important decisions in her life. And she became a positive thinker. And then she sort of figured out a whole lot of, strategies to freedom, independence, and prosperity. And what makes this book so really unusual, and I was really so impressed with and still very impressed with it, is the fact that she decided, she just had a change of attitude, a change of faith in herself and in her God, and she changed her life around, and she became a successful writer and a successful doctorate degree, and now she has found that she is helping other women do the same thing. So as soon as she's called in, we are going to be talking to her. And I'll skip to tell you notice some other things that she is going to. She's going also, by the way, she's going to give you, you know, different steps. Those of you who are having a hard time, those of you who are in an awful position without intending to, and, you know, sometimes you do get into a situation where you've lost things, lost the money, lost the job, and so forth and so on. And so she really, this book I found to be one very special book. I didn't expect to find it. But she deserves a lot of praise for this book. What is her name? Her name is Elise Wiggins, and the name of her book is A Farewell to Welfare, and it's on the market, and you can get it. I'm going to tell you how when she gets on. And she says in her dedication that I dedicate this book to the mothers who sacrifice daily without much help just to keep a roof over their children's heads. Food in their stomach, clothes on their backs, knowledge in their minds, love in their hearts, and smiles on their faces. She says also that she prays this book will inspire you to take responsibility to improve you and your children's future. And she also says that 10% of each book sold will be donated to the Gift of Being Me Foundation that she has set up to support the socioeconomic stability of disadvantaged women and children worldwide. You know, now that is absolutely wonderful. And the name of the book, as I said, is A Farewell to Welfare. So as soon as she calls in, you know, we're going to be talking to her. The book is fantastic.
Right. That's great. And we'll look forward to talking to her. We're also going to be talking to Congressman Donald Payne Jr. He's been reelected to the 10th Congressional District to be the representative of the 10th Congressional District in New Jersey. Last week, you might have noticed if you tried to listen that we were not on. We forgot to let people know we neglected because we got an opportunity to see the Fela kind of review at the NJ PAC Center last week. And it was really a great, great show. Those of you who have seen the original Fela show on Broadway, as you did, Mom, great experience. And this was something similar to that. It wasn't quite what you were able to experience on a Broadway stage that was totally dedicated to that performance. But it gave us a great rendering of that show. And so also we're talking about, obviously, this week, President-elect Mr. Trump is making his transition team and all that stuff. So hold on. It's going to be an interesting ride, ladies and gentlemen. And I believe that we have our first guest here. We're going to open up your mic and welcome you to the show. How are you today?
Edwise, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Good evening, everyone. How are you?
Fine. How are you doing?
All is well. Thank you for having me on the show.
Listen, thanks for coming on. I found this book, as you know, I told you before, this book is absolutely fascinating. And for you to, you know, put this down on paper in a book that people could, you know, people who are in need and in your position that you were in at one particular time, you know, I mean, you give out such strength in this book. And it's really a fascinating story. You know, you talk about your life before welfare, and then you just got to be a positive thinker. And therefore, that's what you are, you know, also, you know, giving out to women who are listening in, and also to other families. You don't have to be a woman to, you know, listen to this and listen to it, at least, because it is really, you actually give strategies to freedom, independence, and prosperity. So, give me some other information about how you came about doing this.
Okay, well, to start off, I am actually an adjunct. I teach sociology at LaGuardia Community College. I teach a course called Urban Studies. And in this course, we examine cities from a political, economic, and social perspective. And what I found is that since LaGuardia is a very diverse community, college, my students were, like, really, really bored with the theories. Like, it didn't resonate with their everyday life. So I started to use the strategies and everyday theories to say, listen, this is how, you know, this is what's going on in your life, and this is how you relate it. At the end of the class, I would have a line of students waiting to tell me about their personal problems. There were instances where I had students come to class with marks around their necks, black eyes. I have students who told me that they're homeless. They couldn't attend all of the classes because if they didn't attend a public assistance appointment, they would lose their public assistance or they would lose their place in bed. And this was preventing them from becoming really great students. Like, it wasn't that they weren't smart or they weren't capable. It was just that they had all of these extenuating life circumstances. So I began to write the 25 strategies because I couldn't see all of my students individually because I'm a single mother. So it was like, as soon as the professor hat was off, then it was the mommy hat. And then I'm glad that you know, we're talking about this. I found out about the Path to Prosperity budget, which Paul Ryan proposed in 2012, where they were seeking to eliminate, you know, social service programs. And I thought that my students needed to know about this because there was no one talking about it at the time. And if they were, it was like, oh, that's a conspiracy theory, or they can't do that, or that's not going to happen, or you're crazy. But now, after, you know, the recent election, everything that I talked about in my book, my research has come to pass. So So after I did the research, then my personal life began to fall apart. And it seemed like everything that I was helping others with and all of the research that I was conducting, it began to happen to me. So I had to write the book from a personal approach so that my readers would know this wasn't just research. This was my actual life. I lived this.
Yeah. And so when, how did you first start presenting it to the public, though? And how did you get the women to come in to listen to you? And well, how did that problem, that situation happen?
Well, what I did, how did you go before I, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I want to know how you draw, how you got the women together. I mean, how did you do this? Did you go into a school to say, this is, I'm going to do, these are my strategies for so-and-so? Or how did you go about it? And how did the women come to you in the first place?
Okay. Before I finished writing the book, what happened is I did like a comparative analysis. I wanted to do like a test study to see how the book would be received. So I worked part-time at a shelter, a woman's shelter in Brownsville, Brooklyn. And I worked at the shelter on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and I was teaching classes Mondays and Wednesdays or either or. And what happens is my college students were excited about the information. Like, they admitted they did have problems and things that they needed to overcome. However, they were really anxious and excited to implement the strategies, whereas the women in the shelter, we couldn't even get to page one of my book because these women were dealing with childhood issues, things that were so traumatic, it was beyond my control. Like, they needed a social worker or a therapist. So what I did with the women in the shelter is I opened up a forum for a women's group. And what I've learned through this experience is that sometimes people just need to talk. They need to be heard. So that's what I did for the women in the shelter. Now, after I published the book, what I started to do is I started to go into environments that nobody really wanted to go in. So, for example, I'm in negotiations now to go into the women's prison at Rikers, Rosie, to get into women who, like, nobody really wants to deal with, where society has marginalized them. So I've traveled to many different shelters. My new audience now that I'm seeing is a lot of what they call trouble youth or at-risk youth. So recently I've been working in Job Corps throughout the country, and I've been speaking to those 16 to 24-year-olds who might have had some trouble. You know, everybody has a past, and it's like, okay, now what do I do? So what going out now that the book is available, I'm realizing it's not just women who need the information that I'm sharing. It's anyone who's determined to succeed. However, their circumstances and or environment is not conducive to their dream.
And certainly I'm quite sure that a lot of them saw a way out, and they decided to listen and, you know, pay attention to what was really going on in their lives, and you gave them a whole lot of hope. But how did you get people to listen to you? This is the thing. How did you become? Let's take it to Rikers where you went. What were their what were their problems initially?
You know what I'm learning? So when I walk into the room and I'm like, I introduce myself and I give all of my titles. I'm a professor. I'm a coach. I'm a people are like, yeah, womp. But when I start to say I was the victim of domestic violence, when I tell them that I had to scrape up change to feed my two children, when I tell them that I was homeless, when I start to be transparent with them and let them know who I am personally, not professionally and academically, people's body languages change. They respond to me differently. Everybody wants to hear what I have to say when they realize I, too, have gone through something. And I had to let the women at Rikers know, you know, I could be right where you are. It's just circumstances and fate that changed my situation from your situation. So the fact that we're meeting here is no accident, because there are a couple of times that I made the wrong decision and I could have been in prison, but God, right? So now the fact that I'm going back into prison in a different way is all in my belief that it's divine, that I had to experience the things that I experienced in order for me to go back and help others. So that's how I'm realizing it now.
Hey, Elise, this is Eric.
Hi, Eric.
How are you? You know, you said something interesting. You know, when people have been through certain circumstances and people that are going through hardships and things like this, and I'm kind of coming in the middle of the interview, that they, you know, you walk in with all of your degrees and things like that, but then you let them know that I was like you too at one time. You know, I walked that walk. And you also talked about people sometimes just needed someone to listen and talk to them. And I've noticed, I'm sure maybe you've noticed as well, that society, when people are homeless, and sometimes people are kind of make fun of and avoid people who just start talking to them and want someone to listen. But oftentimes people want to say to the world, I exist. I'm here. Don't act like I'm not here. And oftentimes, too many times, we, in our hustle to survive, we don't extend that courtesy and that love to someone who needs, who might be down like that. So I really commend you in what you're doing to let folks know, you know, how to deal with circumstances, that you're not your past, that the past is just that the future is bright before you if you are able to have the skills and to deal with it. So I just wanted to say that in listening to you help many folks with that. What is it? Let me ask you, what is your ultimate goal in helping people writing this book and these many programs that you're going to be involved in and other things that you're trying to pursue and push?
Well, my ultimate goal is one thing, when I sat down with one of the, and I thank you for your kind words. And let me back up a bit before I even answer that question. I grew up really spoiled and privileged. My grandparents raised me. My mom was a single mother. She was at work all the time. And her parents, you know, they brought me up. My grandparents were from down south, old school. I never had a care in the world. I never had to worry about anything. And when I got older and I made my own choices in life, and I started to see what my family was trying to, like, have me avoid, I realized, wow, life isn't all sweet. Everyone didn't grow up the way I did. And there was a time where I was very selfish. There was a time where I was very uppity and my nose was in the air and I wouldn't talk to certain people and I wouldn't look at certain people. So I have to say that this experience has truly humbled me and it's made me a more compassionate person. You know, when you have two children and they're looking at you like, mommy, well, how are we going to eat? And there's no one else for you to go to for your survival. You know, my grandparents are all gone. So it's like, okay, Elise, you're in their shoes now and they always made sure you ate. So now what? And that's what's made me compassionate. But my overall goal with this is really, like I said, it wasn't initially my story because I didn't have a story. I wanted to really write my book to warn people how to get themselves together, how to stop being dependent on government programs, subsidies. Even if you're in a relationship or you have someone that you're dependent on, the whole goal of my work is to promote personal responsibility, right? And what I had to realize is that some people can't get to the level of personal responsibility because of childhood issues. So when I went into the jail and I had the meeting with the director, she said to me 85% of the women in prison were labeled as having a mental disorder. And I thought to myself, wow, it's amazing because I could have been labeled as having a mental disorder or bipolar had I not had the foundation from my family, had I not had the spiritual foundation to say, God, help me. You know, I know that I can't be labeled like this. So my goal is to bring awareness to the fact that everybody doesn't have mental disorders. Sometimes people just need to talk. They need someone that they can trust and that they can confide in. And then once you open the door for that type of conversation, hope can begin. Like I look at so many women and I meet with them and there's no hope in their eyes and it saddens me. And then once you give them the chance to start talking, well, what are your goals and what do you see this and you see this light shine, it's like that's my ultimate goal. I want people to know that there is still hope regardless who the president is, regardless who is running our country. We have to know who we are, and we have to be in charge now of our goals and our dreams. So that's my overall message.
Right. And that's really what we should be about as human beings when we try to work with people and try to interact with each other. You know, it's the ultimate person who works to help someone feel good about themselves, you know, and I really commend and admire that about you, that you're sharing these tools with people, because they're tools that people need. You know, like you, as you found out, life is hard, and sometimes, you know, the compiling nature of life, you know, it doesn't, like you said, it doesn't make a difference, or it shouldn't make a difference as much who the president is, who these people are, that you still have worth and you can still work to achieve your dreams. And many times, like you said, people are labeled certain ways because nobody just took the time to help them and to show them and help them develop the skills to do that. And I think that should be the goal of our society. I think that should be the goal of people who seek public office, to help our society together. If we really are striving to be the type of society that we promote to the rest of the world, that America is such a great place, we should strive to help every person to be self-sufficient and responsible. And I think it's a very important thing that we work to get people off of the assistance and dependence on not only other people but the government programs and things like that. That's been one of the drawbacks, obviously, when you look at it from a generational standpoint. And I'm speaking particularly within the issues of African Americans, who kind of, you know, some of us have become dependent, you know, on these kind of government programs, right? And so we hope that, and obviously the goal that you're trying to help people achieve is to get off of that dependence, you know, and to become independent. And there's nothing like it when a person is responsible for themselves, when they're achieving themselves, when they're achieving those goals. And you're doing the Lord's work, I really feel. And I would promote and suggest that everybody go out and buy this book to help out.
And you know, it's not as at least you say in the book that it's not initially a book. This is a report that you were writing to bring awareness to future budget cuts and, you know, involving what the government is implementing. But despite your circumstances, you say, you woke up every morning determined and inspired to achieve your goals. Now, as a result of working with Elise, somebody says, I was able to make up my mind and decide what was best for me and my children. Now, did you have them visualize, you know, what they should be doing or what they had been doing and what they were going to be doing, you know, in the future? How did you keep people having hope?
Okay, so like I said, with the difference when I worked with the women at the shelter who were completely, like, hopeless, so for example, imagine sitting down with a 40-year-old woman, a woman who's way older than me, right? And she breaks down and she says, you know, I never told anybody this, but I was molested by my uncle or something. And then you allow her to speak about this abuse. You allow her to get it out. You allow her to say what it is that happened, how often it happened, who she told, who ignored her, how it made her feel. And then I say to her, if you knew that if a young girl came to you and told you that they were being touched, what would you do? And then she flipped it and said, no, I want to protect children, and this is why I want to. So it's a matter of allowing people, giving them the space to talk about things that people don't want to hear, that normally people are like, shh, don't talk about that. No, we don't want to hear it. No, 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 no. Sometimes you just need to get it out. So when I was working with those women, it was more therapeutic where they just needed to talk and get things out, and then we could talk about the future. So, for example, with my students at, like, LaGuardia, I have one student who was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, and she was really, really depressed about it, broke up with a boyfriend. I hadn't been in contact with her for years, and for some reason I contacted her through social media. Together, she and I, now she's writing a book. She healed herself of diabetes by changing her eating habits. and showing like what foods are prone for you to have so that you will have diabetes. She changed her diet. She's making her own products now, right? And she's not selling it for outrageous prices. She's really going out and helping the communities. And, in fact, I think she's working with a public school in the Bronx. I have another woman that I was working with. She was a grandmother. She was afraid to go back into school, but she wanted to get out of the job market. She thought she was in dead-end jobs. She's now on her way to getting her PhD. I call her for advice now, right? So it's like the people that I work with, I'm thankful that they've become my mentors. So the people who were looking up to me for support and help, I'm now reaching out to them. Like, I'm contacting my student, like, okay, I'm making this. What ingredients should I put in? And she's like, okay, well, this is how you do that. And that, and it's a beautiful thing when you learn reciprocity. So one thing I was always told, you won't, you know, it's not always about you. Today for you, tomorrow for me. So right now, if you're using me to get up the ladder, I might be using you to get up the ladder in a year or two.
Sure.
So it's all about allowing people to have a vision, like saying, okay, this is what happened to you. And another thing is I tell people, too, if I hadn't gone through what I've gone through in terms of my relationship with my children's father, being homeless while I was a professor, being on public assistance while I was on I was a professor, living in poverty while I was a professor with two children, I would not be who I am today. So what we have to understand is that sometimes those storms don't come literally to break us. They come to teach us about who we are, who's with us. So I have to realize that in everything that I've gone through, I can look back and I can cry and I can complain and I can say, woe is me. Or I can say, you know what, Elise, this situation made me. So that's what
it
I
helped.
Want to say about that.
Yeah, you had experienced it and you were going to find your way out. And I'm quite sure that that was enormously helpful, you know, to some of the women. Now, you probably changed hundreds of lives, and you have this outline of what you did. In other words, you just weren't going to take it anymore, all right? And what you did was the women you had always supported, they were down, you know, and then treated life as a burden, I would imagine, and you gave them hope. You said, you don't have to do this. You're more than this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You have to visualize and meditate about what you are doing because you are worthy of living, and you are worthy. You have a story to tell. So just don't, you know, be down on yourself to the point where you feel that you don't have a story to tell. Because all of us have a story to tell. I think the reason why I wanted to get you with the book was when you told me about it, and then I read it, I said, wow, this is really, really something. And it's a gift.
Let me just ask, Lisa, how long have you been doing this? And also, to what is there, what's the spiritual component, if there is, in when you work with many of these people, in terms of passing on the faith in God and things like that?
Okay, well, I've been doing this unofficially since 2012. So immediately after I separated from my children's father, I felt like it was my calling to start helping people because I thought that if I helped them, I would heal myself in a way. But then, you know, life circumstances hit me again, death, depression, and it was like, Elise, you got to go more in. So I started a business last year, 2015, and now I'm working to get a MWBE, which is Women Minority Business Enterprises certification, where I can work with the government. So that's how I'm able to negotiate contracts with Job Corps and Department of Corrections, and also I'm working with the library because now my company is certified to work with the government. So officially 2015, unofficially 2012. The spiritual piece to this, and this is something I get in a little bit of trouble for. So just recently we know President-elect Trump came into office, and I couldn't even teach my classes because my students were so depressed. Some of them were angry. You could feel the tension in the classroom. Like, some of them felt like depressed, you know, so it was like, okay, I have to change the format of my class today just to add a different piece. And I showed a clip of T.D. Jakes on Oprah back in 2012 where he's talking about passion, purpose, and pain, and how you have to use your pain and turn it into something good. And I was just so happened I was being observed that day. But, you know, normally when you know somebody's watching you, you put on, you want to put your best. But, you know, I didn't come to class to please my observer. I came to class for my students. And as a result, I got a bad write-up. You know, my write-up, it stated that she felt like my class had no academic basis. She felt like I was swaying them with propaganda, and she doesn't understand the relevance of the T.D. Jakes video. And I just had a meeting with her yesterday, and I had to tell her, look, these are human beings we're educating. They're not robots. So I can't always just stick to an academic theoretical script with people who are hurting. I have to respond to them first, and once I know that they're okay, then we can move forward. So that. But when I'm working with people individually and they'll tell me their problems, they'll say, well, this is what I'm going through. The first thing I ask them is, what are your spiritual beliefs? Do you believe in God? And they'll say yes. Once the person says yes, that's it. I'm all the way in.
Yeah.
I don't care if you're Muslim. I was Muslim for 10 years. I don't care if you're Jewish. I don't care if you're Catholic, Christian, Buddhist, anything. When you say to me, I believe in God, that's when I can start speaking to you from a spiritual perspective, allowing you to know who you are and whose you are. Because I think what the problem is and where we get it misconstrued is people start arguing over religion. The word religion was derived from a Latin word called religioso, which means back to bondage. So if you think about it, religion divides people more than it brings them together. The Muslims over here, the Jews over here, no. If we're human beings and we all bleed red blood, let's all come together. And once I start to explain that principle, it's like, oh, you're right. I never thought about it. Whether you pray 5 times a day, 2 times a day, if you pray all day, as long as you understand that there's a higher power, then we have a mutual common bond. So when I coach people, when I talk to them, I go intellectual with them. I could go psychological with them. I can go geographically. I have to go any way I can. I go straight hood with them. Sometimes I'll say things in class that'll just throw my students off. Like if I notice that I'm teaching something that's important and my students are texting or I see them on Facebook, I'll say something really inappropriate and they'll drop it and be like, oh, what did she just say? Did I get your attention? Okay, back to the lesson. So my thing is, as long as we can find a mutual common ground and that being God, that's when the floodgates are open for me to help.
Yeah. You become them and they become you, in other words. Yeah, you know, one thing is, it's so great. I love the book and it's really very powerful, and I'm recommending it that everybody get the book, A Farewell to Welfare, by Elise Wiggins, and a great book. You're going to enjoy the book at the same time giving you a whole lot of answers to a whole lot of problems, and you have to get them out in order for you to, you know, sort of get more confidence in yourself, okay, in ourselves. So at least, listen, we'll have to have you on again because of the fact that I know we're going to get some calls, you know, later on. Thank you so much, at least Wiggins. The name of the book is A Farewell to Welfare, and you can pick it up at any bookstore, I would imagine.
It's not in the bookstores yet, but this is the thing. I have it in the libraries because I'm understanding that the audience I wrote the book for may not have $20 to go on Amazon and buy the book.
Yeah.
They might, right?
Yeah.
So it's available now at the Brooklyn Public Libraries and the Queens Libraries. I'm working out the other boroughs, but if you want to purchase it, it's on my website, which is www.afarewelltowelfare.com, the title of the book, one word, afarewelltowelfare.com. It can also be purchased on Amazon. And if anyone would like to get in contact with me, I'm Elise Wiggins on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. That's my social media information.
And you spell Elise, E-L-E-A-S-E, Wiggins, W-I-G-G-I-N-S. I just wanted to get that straight. Okay? Yes. And the name of the book, once again, Elise, is?
A Farewell to Welfare, 25 Strategies to Freedom, Independence, and Prosperity.
And it is wonderful, everyone. I strongly recommend this book, and I'm quite sure you're going to be on with us again, Elise. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me, everyone. Enjoy your holiday. God bless you all.
You too.
You too. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Elise Wiggins. With she is doing God's work, and she is doing the work for her fellow human beings, and she needs to be commended for that. Once again, I admire and respect her for reaching out to other women, and also I think a lot of men really can use that help as well, without a doubt. So we really appreciate her gracing us with her presence and allowing us to interview her on our show here. We're going to move over into the current issues of the day. We're supposed to have Congressman Donald Payne Jr. Calling in. I know that he is at doing the work that most elected officials do, and he's at a function, so hopefully he'll be calling in soon. As you all know, we are in, second or third week in the election of Donald Trump. This week he's been meeting with people, putting his transition team in place. Interestingly enough, obviously some of the people that really didn't vote for him or campaigned against him, he's been meeting with, like Mitt Romney, considering him for a Secretary of State, Nikki Haley, who actually he's going to be making her a part of his cabinet, who was a Marco Rubio supporter, and then a Ted Cruz supporter. I respect the governor of South Carolina in that she stood up to make sure the Confederate flag came down. Obviously, thus showing that there are things that the Republicans and Democrats can come together on, particularly when it's a symbol of hate in this country. And her being a person of Indian descent, she certainly understands. And also her personal relationship to at least one of the people, the state representative that was one of the people that got murdered in that shooting in South Carolina by that young man, one of the people in the prayer group there. So Donald Trump is making the moves, and also he also settled one of the lawsuits about the Trump University, where he had to settle for $25 million. I find it interesting he likes to give out the nicknames and calling Hillary Crooked Hillary. And one of the first things that comes out is that he's settling a lawsuit for the kind of the fraud case of his university, as well as a number of other things. Conflict of interest issues that are arising. Meeting with the Japanese Prime Minister, in which his daughter and son-in-law sat in on his 60-minute interview, in which his daughter used that to sell her jewelry that she happened to be wearing during the course of that interview. It's kind of hypocritical, I think, to suggest that the Clinton Foundation was a money-making foundation, and here this guy has all of these business interests all over the world, and he's meeting with these heads of state, the guy from Britain. He also mentioned, can you get rid of those wind turbines or something that were off the water near his golf course or something like that. So it's kind of hypocritical to a certain degree, some of the things that he's doing. And also, too, he's backpedaling. Well, he's really starting to realize that you can't just be hardcore extreme with some of that. Are you trying to show me something, Mom? You're trying to show me something. Okay.
Yes, I am.
Trying to let me know to let you folks know the calling number, which is also here on our screen. If somebody would like to call in, it's 323-679-0906. It's our call-in number. And write this down for future episodes when we're on live, 323-679-0906. And the president-elect is kind of a backpedaling or softening his stance on a lot of the issues that he had promoting from a hardcore basis, global warming. Even though one of the guys he's going to put in charge of the EPA is a kind of anti-global warming person.
Mm-hmm.
He's backpedaling on, of course, he's going to have Hillary prosecuted, which if she could have been prosecuted, believe me, the Republicans would have prosecuted her a long time ago.
Right.
So he wasn't going to be able to do that, in my estimation, unless he set up his government to go after her. I mean, if you have someone like Rudy Giuliani, and you appoint him Attorney General, I'm sure that he would have found a way or made some people, have some people make up some laws to arrest Hillary. Also, I saw in some of the people that were going in, some of the news footage that were going in, there were a couple of black folk. He's talking about making Uncle Ben. I call him Uncle Ben. There's a new phrase. It's not Uncle Tom anymore. I'll be calling it Uncle Ben. And I'm sure Uncle Ben, of Uncle Ben's rights, is rolling over in his grave that now this guy comes out, he's referred to as Uncle Ben. But Ben Carson, they're thinking about making him HUD secretary, which is kind of usually, to me, I think that's maybe the position that you normally make, the minority, Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, if I think of that still.
Yeah, but you have to know what you're doing.
You do have to know what you're doing, and that's the whole thing about the about Carson, but also about the whole notion that people wanted to get rid of the politicians. I understand that to a certain degree, oh, don't get me wrong. We understand that, you know, sometimes people get in, we put these people in places, they get drunk with their power, they abuse it a little bit, but also doesn't mean that everybody that's in politics or working in government is bad. And so this notion of anybody could do that, throw them out, just put anybody in there is lunacy. And so let me give you an example. If you needed to get heart surgery, would you just want to use someone who had never done it before?
Yeah.
Or would you want to use somebody that had a resume? If you needed a neurosurgeon, would you want to use Dr. Ben Carson, who had, that's his reputation of being a brilliant neurosurgeon, or would you just want to use somebody who just got off the street because you wanted a fresh perspective? So it's a little bit, it's not as cut and dry. It's not as black and white as some people would like to make it out to be. That's why there are complicated issues in running the government. That's why he's meeting with people who have had experience in running the government. Donald Trump is a businessman, so certainly he understands that you want to have people in place that know what they're doing. And so to suggest that we want to throw them all out, just put anybody in people who don't understand the workings of government or don't understand the reasoning for certain things, is kind of ridiculous in my perspective. I kind of think that he rallied his base off of the backs or off of the notion of racial statements.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I just would like to ask some of my friends who would happen to vote for Donald Trump, what would be a non-starter for you? I mean, certain things are non-starters for me. And an individual comes out and wants to seek public office, the highest office in the land, and one of the first statements he makes in that political career, the beginning of his career, is derogatory statements about people of Mexican descent. And so to me, that would probably be a non-starter as a person of color if I saw someone else wanting to run for office and some of the first things that they say are derogatory things about another ethnic group. That would probably be a non-starter for me. Or if they said negative things about people who happen to be Jewish, like his strategy guy, mm-hmm. Bannon has alleged to say about folks who happen to be Jewish. Wanted to say.
Yeah, and, you know, also when I first heard him speak, and they were talking about, Trump running for the presidency, the first thing after I heard him speak, I said, he is Hitleristic. You remember when I said that? You know, I said, there's something about him that, you know, it's Hitleristic. He doesn't have any respect for anyone other than himself. And he was having all this negative, you know, these negative adjectives about, you know, all kinds of people other than himself, what he would do. I think that he forgot that he wasn't playing his game, The Apprentice, and that he was he had the nerve, the guts, the gall to run for the most important, you know, job, if you will, in the country, the president of the United States of America, the president of the world, really, you know, because the United States is the most powerful, you know, country in the whole world. I said, how are you going to get a nut? You know, with this kind of nonsense, you know, that he was talking about. It was just so strange, you know. And, you know, but really, you know, he really made me a little worried about, you know, for a while there, because I thought that all these people coming out of the woodwork, you know, those Nazi people that were, you know, Heil Hitler, wearing him and, you know, saying things about blacks and Indians and so forth and so on, and you're going to build a wall and then, you know, send people back and, you know, that kind of thing. That was just so off the wall. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe I was hearing it.
Yeah, I thought that, I personally kind of questioned Donald Trump being a racist because of several things. His watching the show The Apprentice, and he had black people on the show, seemed not to have a problem. He had other black people as well. But my point is, and watching his interaction also, at one point my sister was doing a little interview show where they do like celebrity styles on the red carpet, and they were at an event, and Donald Trump, they were able to interview Donald Trump, and he seemed to be pretty cool. And this is around the time when that, and coupled with The Apprentice and things like that, which was, I was a fan of that show in the beginning, that was like, oh, Donald Trump's not that bad. You know, he's a rich guy who might have business practices that might, some people might not agree with sometimes, throws his weight around. But I kind of thought he was okay. Certainly I didn't want him to be president, but I didn't mind, you know, a lot of people thought that he was a brilliant businessman, The Art of the Deal. I know that my father had that book at the house that we grew up in. So a lot of people, you know, gave him his just due as an astute businessman. I first heard about Donald Trump in the 70s when the Atlantic City approved casino gaming to make it gambling legal in Jersey, and when he was buying property so he could build a casino. And there was a news story about an old lady who had property that he was trying to purchase because it was in the way of building his thing. And of course, you figure, I mean, why not? You know, wouldn't that be a great windfall for somebody to have property that a millionaire wants to buy so he can build his – he's offering you to buy your property so he can build his big development project? I mean, I would have – you know, at the time I was thinking, sure, I would have – why wouldn't she sell to him unless – he was offering people pennies on the dollar for their house.
Mm-hmm.
And this old woman who didn't have any place else to go, this apparently had been her house for a long time. It was a news story how they were building the casino around her play, her home, and, you know, dealing with the construction all going on around her and stuff like that. And, you know, the news story kind of pitted the old lady against the rich billionaire. So I thought he was, you know, one of those kind of jerky rich people who was trying to take advantage of people less fortunate. That was in Atlantic City when Atlantic City first started building the casinos. Mm-hmm. So I had a negative opinion of him from that time on until, more, as I said, more recently, this situation, my sister and The Apprentice show. And he seemed to be, you know, a guy who, you know, a basic New Yorker. But this, ironically, is changing opinion of mine, and maybe a lot of people had, was after the Central Park jogger case, in which he took out a full-page ad in the New York Times talking about these young men, these young black boys and Hispanic boys that had been rounded up and really railroaded to people think that they were guilty of this crime, which they weren't. It came out that they weren't. And he took out that full-page ad in the New York Times talking about they should get to do all these negative things. I don't remember exactly what it was. So that was a really negative time, and it was really extreme. You wanted to say?
Yeah, I want to say that at the time I was working at WLIB BOS, doing one of the shows there at the radio station, and these kids were playing in the park. They were playing, you know, as young boys do, you know, jumping and running and so forth and so on. Well, what had happened was that someone had beaten a white woman in the park. And so it hit the papers, and the person who took out a full-page ad on these young boys, they were like 13, 14. When I say young, they were kids on like junior high school. They weren't high school kids, you know, and that person who took out that full-page ad talking about these young black and I think maybe one Latino, you know, kids did this crime without even any knowledge or anything. Well, you know, the police in New York at that particular time were, I'll put it right out there, racist, a lot of them. Giuliani probably understands what I was talking about, by the way. And we were on the air, and I was absolutely furious. And then a friend of mine called, who had been with, I think she was either with CBS or NBC, I forget right now, I can call her and ask her. She called me, she said, you know what? She said, Katie, listen, I know who did that. He admitted it to me, and also the NYPD knew it at the time, okay? And I'm not going to say her name. However, she was a hot, you know, news reporter at that time. And but Trump kept doing this with the whole wilding thing. So you can call these kids, they were the worst, and they were like animals. And he kept having his ads in the paper, full page, without knowing what the heck he was talking about. So that was my, you know, my introduction to Donald Trump. You know, that he just, you know, he got this information. I don't know where he got it from, but he picked it up and he ran with it. Oh. And so what happened with these kids was they went to jail for a period of years. Sure, they got, you know, millions of dollars, but they lost, I don't even know how many years now, because of his ads in the New York Times, full-page ads, all right? And wait a minute, and my friend, you know, said the NYPD knew who did it because he was in jail, okay? And he had talked to her.
Who's he?
The person who did it, I'm sorry. I mean, it wasn't, the guy who did it, because he had been in jail, and he admitted it. And he admitted it to her because he knew that he could come, trust her and whatnot.
Yeah, if I could say, I take a little different take on it, because I don't know if it was common knowledge at the time, at that time, that
The cops did it. The kids are wild. They're playing in the park.
Well,
and they're making noise. They're black and Latino.
Here's the thing. We know what wilding meant. Those of us who were in New York City at the time, wilding out is cats were doing little wild things. You know, some of it might have been criminal. Some of it might not have been. What we do know is that the perception and the narrative that was set forth was that these guys had beat and raped and really savagely, someone had savagely beat this woman in the park, and cops rounded up these kids and charged them with the crime. And so that was the narrative going on in the city. I don't know whether I remember when they were saying that these kids were looking like these kids were the ones that did it. The cops were pegging for that they did it. So that narrative went out to the city, went out to the public. So people were responding to that, and I don't know whether
they were responding to that because Donald Trump put that in the paper without having any information whatsoever.
Well, as I remember, they came out and charged these kids. It's not that Trump pushed the narrative that these kids committed the crime. The cops charged them with the crime, said these were the boys that did it. After and during that time, the whole time is when perhaps he came out with the thing. It's not that he pushed it, that
did push it. He pushed that story when he had no information, okay?
Well,
I was on the air then, and I was talking to this person, friend
right,
of mine.
Understood. My point
you
is
know,
that
he had that story. She said the guy admitted to her that
right.
He did the crime, and that the NYPD had this guy in jail anyway.
Right, but that's not something that the general public. And
well,
what you're saying is that Donald Trump, you're indicating that Donald Trump knew that they.
He knew it.
Okay. I don't know whether that.
He
was,
didn't know anything, but he. You know,
he assumed like a lot of other people. But we don't want to suggest that he knew that they did not commit the crime. That's not actually accurate to say that he knew that they did not commit the crime, and then he pushed.
He put that story in the paper without having the proper information or any information. In other words, he was the one that made sure that these kids went to jail for doing something that they didn't do.
The criminal justice system that came down harder on people of color was that. He jumped on the bandwagon, took out a full page ad. And which helped to push them towards getting guilty. I don't think that what you're suggesting, to me it sounds like anyway, is that he knew ahead of time that they didn't commit the crime, and therefore he pushed it anyway that they should get committed with the crime. I don't believe that is historically accurate. I think what's historically accurate is that the narrative was created that these guys, kids were rounded up, obviously because the criminal justice system comes down on our people a little bit more harder than they would everybody else. And we know during that time some of those things were happening. And then the narrative was created that these kids were responsible for this crime. Trump, as many Americans and many New Yorkers at the time, hopped on the bandwagon because he was a wealthy person, took out this full-page ad talking about what should happen to them with the wilding and things like that. And so that helped to fuel the fire in an already outrageous, contentious situation to get these kids convicted.
It was because of him, because of Donald Trump, that they came down on these kids without the NYPD being sure that these kids might have done it. Okay. Period.
Okay. I'm gonna respectfully disagree with that. I was
on the air and I knew exactly what was going on in the papers. Andy Cooper had, you know, said, look at this in the paper without any information. You know, they would let the kids talk to their parents. Did you know that?
Right. I understand that, but I'm not saying what you're indicating is that it was all Donald Trump's fault.
I'm not saying. I'm not. But he
added fuel to the flame.
I'm not disagreeing with you.
But let's not suggest that Donald Trump led the pitchfork and said, let's hang these guys. He jumped on the bandwagon.
He jumped on the bandwagon
along with everybody else that would just assume these kids were guilty and did not give them a fair trial. Him, Rudy, everybody else. They naturally assumed, because they had a preconceived notion of young black and Hispanic men, that these kids did this. And wilding was a term that was used back in the day. You're wilding out. These guys are wilding out. Now, you weren't really hanging out. You weren't really closer to the age range of these kids I was. And so wilding out was a term that was used when cats were being wild, doing wild stuff. And that was a term that was going on. Cats would run through, robbing people, and do whatever. So that was kind of a term, a phrase, when people are getting too wild or just tripping out or doing, not to say that it only means negative stuff, but when they're getting a little bit rambunctious.
It's negative when you're accused of a crime that you don't commit because
right.
of the color of your skin, period.
Exactly.
Okay?
But let's be accurate in our facts when we say that this person pushed the narrative that they're guilty. The narrative was already there, and all these people just had a rush to judgment, like they have been doing with our people in the history of the United States.
Did not put an ad, a full page.
Because he was a millionaire, and he was giving his opinion what should happen. He too jumped on the thing. So we're not going to
without adequate information. He just
right. He was running with the information that was already out there that the general public knew. Not that he had,
and maybe
I'm not giving him any leeway either. But I want us to be accurate what we're talking about. So to suggest that Donald Trump is the one that pushed the narrative to get these kids convicted is incorrect. He jumped on the bandwagon. He helped push the narrative forward, but it was him and a whole bunch of other people. He was a rich man who was able to take out this full-page ad and say, you know, lock them up or do whatever. But they were already on the train going down. The cops had already tried. The cops had already summed up the fact that these kids had done that. And Rudy, who was mayor at the time, was going along with it. So we've come to the end of our show. We have a lively discussion. We're going to try to get Congressman Payne next week or at another time. Obviously, the event that he was at was a little bit time-consuming for him, so he was not able to call in this evening. But we want to remind everybody that we're live every Wednesday evening, 8 to 9 p.m. If you missed the show, you can listen to our show at any time you want because it's archived on the Blog Talk Radio Network, blogtalkradio.com. /K Thompson Live is when you can listen in to the K Thompson Live show. Anytime you want, listen to any episode that you want. And also thanks to...
And Lisa Wiggins, thank you very much for, you know, presenting your Farewell to Welfare book, and people can get it at any store, I would imagine, of Farewell to Welfare by Elise Wiggins.
All right. Thanks once again, everybody, for listening to the K Thompson Live show. I am Eric Payne, also known as The Sun. And you are?
Kay Thompson. Join us, Kay Thompson Live, every Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m.
Thanks a lot, everybody, for listening. We'll see you again next weekend. Mm-hmm.